do believe it has relevance for quantum gravity,
and that's why I have asked to be speaking in this particular seminar. I lost my little whatchamacallit here already. So first let me start out what I'm intending to do, and then show you how I intend to do it. So I'm seeking a faithful quantization. I will explain that on the next slide. Faithful quantization of interacting scalar fields for all space-time dimensions. We don't have that today. How am I going to do it? I'm going to try to solve high-dimension models first and then extend to lower dimensions. That's exactly what we don't do currently. We take the least singular things in two and three dimensions and use the techniques from those two and three dimensions and extrapolate them to higher dimensions, and it doesn't work. And, of course, I'm going to use soluble models as a principal guide. So I promised you a definition of faithful quantization. There it is. Start with a classical theory. You quantize this classical theory, and then you take the classical limit of that quantum theory. You should come back to the original classical theory. That's a faithful quantization. There are examples which don't do that, and I will discuss those. How are we going to quantize? Well, quantization is ambiguous. There are H-bar ambiguities present in going from the classical to the quantum theory. We can use those to our advantage, and we do use those in our traditional field theory. But they shouldn't be arbitrary. Quantum corrections need not be arbitrary, but they should be restricted in nature. And two slides from now, I'll kind of explain what I mean by that. And here's perhaps a new idea for you. When the coupling constant continuity fails, when the theory is discontinuous in the coupling constant, then the free theory is no longer relevant, and I will explain that on the slide too. Now I'm far from my tools. Suppose the classical Hamiltonian is given by capital H of little p and q, little p and little q, those are the C number variables. It's natural that the quantum Hamiltonian could start as capital H, capital P, and capital Q. These are the Heisenberg operators, then the classical limit of this term should look like that. That's basically okay. But we can add corrections to that which disappear in the classical limit, say things proportional to H bar. We could actually put almost anything over here so long as it had a positive power of H bar, which disappeared when it went to zero. For example, when we have infinitely many degrees of freedom, we often use normal ordering as a way to minimize problems. We can take our original Hamiltonian and add the corrections suggested by perturbation theory. I'm going to focus on this particular little example down here. It involves h bar squared and a function only of q. This has the feature that as h bar goes to zero, it should go back to the original classical theory. Let's now look at these things in particular. Here's my h bar squared y of q. I'm going to make a scale transformation. A simple scaling that p goes to s inverse times p, q goes to s times q. That keeps the Heisenberg commutation relation the same. S will be a scalar greater than zero. These q's and the p's could be multi-index variables. So my Hamiltonian operator is going to scale in this particular way, and the correction term here will have a scaling too. Let's take an example to discuss it. Here's my example is 1/2 p squared plus m squared q squared. That's like a harmonic oscillator. Here is a coupling constant g times q to the power 4. That's an anharmonic term. And my term here I will consider to be h bar squared. The y becomes as a power series here. Now, when I put in my s parameter, I will have s to the 4th variations from this term. S squared variations from this term. So it is rather natural that I allow beta equal to 4 because that would correspond to just a modification of the G parameter. Beta equal 2, that corresponds to this. But beta equal to 6, here that's a possible term, but it is not suggested by the original theory. And so I'm not saying it's forbidden. I'm just saying it's not favored. Now there's one other term here, which I claim is favored. That's because when I look at the p and s to the minus 1, then I get an s to the minus 2 here. a scalar with S to the minus 2. And that suggests that beta equal minus 2 should be included along with these guys as being on the same footing.
John, now, so what, if I understand this, I'll understand everything.
If beta not equal to 6 is not favored because...
Because it was not part of the original...
That power was not part of the...
Okay. 6 was not power. There was no S to the power 6 that emerged from here. But there is an S to the minus 2, and beta to the minus 2 would suggest that. Indeed, you are comfortable with beta to the minus 2. Go to spherical problem, 3 dimensions, go to spherical coordinates, you get derivatives with respect to the radius, and you get L plus 1 times h bar squared, in fact, over r squared. So there it is, q to the minus 2. So it is not to be thrown away like beta to the 6 or 66 or anything else. Here is the most unusual of the groundwork I want to give you, that the Coupling constant continuity may fail. Here's my classical action of a harmonic oscillator problem plus a perturbation, which is g times coupling constant g greater than or equal to 0 times x to the minus 4. It's not x to the plus 4, which is your standard example, but x to the minus 4. Let's take g equal to 0 first, so that term is not there. I solve the equations of motion that come from that, that's harmonic oscillator, and I have a set of those solutions, which is called W, F for free because g equals 0. Those solutions are x equal amplitude times cosine of t plus phase. That's the set of those amplitudes, of those solutions. That's the set of solutions at g equal to 0. Now let g be positive. Any amount of positive, and you'll see that the trajectories cannot, are forbidden to cross the axis x equals 0. It's the most easy to see it in the energy rule what this would be. So the solutions when g is positive are all of the form oscillation on the positive side, never crossing the axis, or oscillations on the negative side. So the limit as g goes to 0 of that set of solutions for positive g is equal to this, namely the solutions are either plus or minus absolute value of amplitude times cosine of t plus phase. This is not the same set of solutions as the free theory had. In fact, I give it another name, I call it pseudo-free theory. This is the theory to which the interacting theory is continuously connected as the coupling goes to 0. So here is the free theory. Here is the pseudo-free theory in some kind of abstract world. We'll plot the coupling constant g vertically, and I'm over here, but I turn on the interaction, I'm suddenly over here, and I go up here to have something looking like it. When g is not zero any longer, g is positive. Then I go from g back towards zero, and I never go to the free theory. That's the classical picture, and we're going to see that the quantum picture has the same behavior. Here's the quantum story. This is a question.
So what is the free theory? Is it just a harmonic oscillator with a perfect reflector at the origin?
That would be a good description classically. I can also give you a reasonably good description of quantum mechanics too. So here is the quantum theory in the form of an imaginary time propagator, functional integral. Here's the harmonic oscillator, so it's imaginary time, and it has the change of signs. Here is the interaction term here. And although I cannot solve what the functional form of that looks like, I can tell you what the limit of the interacting solution would be if g went to 0, coupling went to 0. It is not the free propagator, which is down on this line, not equal to this line. We'll come to that in a minute. It's equal to this line. The theta function is either 1 for positive argument and 0 for negative argument. Yes.
Is there a reason that the g changed sign from the classical to quantum Hamiltonian?
Yes, of course, because I've gone to Euclidean imaginary time
No, oh, okay, got it.
So this is the guy who's really changed sign.
Nice.
So this is theta, a positive, if the argument is positive, which says that the starting and final points of your propagator must be both positive or both negative. That's a residue, if you will, of this statement up here. And what you have left over is a different collection of eigenfunctions, although the eigenvalues survive. That's the pseudo-free theory in the quantum theory. It is the limit, the continuous limit, of the interacting theories as the theory goes to zero. Now, you're more familiar with the perturbation which would be x to the plus 4. X to the plus 4 instead of this x to the minus 4 would indeed be continuously connected to the free theory as it went, the coupling went to zero. Even exponential of x to the 4 as a potential in place of this. Notice that this term has an infinity for every perturbation series theory, because in the perturbation theory, you're averaging x to the plus 4 potential in terms of eigenfunctions, which are Gaussian, that fall off like e to the minus x squared. So this is divergent. Every term is divergent. Nevertheless, this theory, too, is continuously connected, not in an analytic sense of the coupling constant, but it is continuously connected to this. It used to be thought that non-renormalizable quantum field theories were like this. They had such a terrible potential that they gave infinity in all the terms of the perturbation analysis, but they were continuously connected, nevertheless, back to the free theory. On the contrary, I'm going to argue for you that the non-renormalizable quantum field theories are more like this example up here, the x to the minus 4 story. Now, why does this behavior happen? Because x to the minus 4 acts partially as a hard core. It projects out certain paths or histories, if you like, which would otherwise have been allowed by the free theory by itself. All those paths that would like to cross the axis, for example. They are projected out for all positive g, and they remain absent in the limit that g goes to zero. There's a pictorial way of describing this a little bit. It's kind of crude, but it might be helpful. The green ellipse describes the paths, the points inside, describe the paths where, let's talk about the quantum theory, where the harmonic term is well-behaved and finite, for example. The larger clear ellipse describes the paths where the interaction term is finite. And you can see by the hidden line, which I'm now filling out for you, that this curve is not inside that curve, meaning that there are paths which are allowed by the free theory here, but forbidden by this interaction term, and they are outside, and they're going to be disappeared when the hard core is doing its activity. Okay. So, what have we learned? The pseudo-free model can become more important than the usual free model. That's even true classically. This, the limiting of the interacting theories is disconnected from the free theory. Perturbation analysis, if it's going to take place, cannot take place about the free theory. It has to take place about the pseudo-free theory. You're already far away from that. To determine the pseudo-free model, that's going to be hard. The free theory, we know what it is. We how to solve it. It's trivial. The pseudo-free theory is kind of an interacting model. It's the limit of a set of interacting models as g goes to zero. I can't really solve it for you, but I can make a good guess of what it might be. And that's what we're going to do. And we're going to determine from that guess a new physical principle. And then we're going to use that physical principle to extend it to the covariant world. Quiet.
Doesn't Hausdorff's theorem reinforce your point to some extent?
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. Hausdorff's theorem is saying that the interacting representation of the commutation relations is not unitarily equivalent to the free theory's representation.
But you're suggesting there's something else, some reference there, that it would be unitarily equivalent.
Hang on. I might even say yes to that. But, you know, 85% today. Okay, anyway.
I'm going to try to first convince you that the covariant, non-normalizable scalar models have a hardcore interpretation. We saw this hardcore in our elementary harmonic oscillator plus perturbation theory. I'm going to show you that a similar behavior arises for those.
We're going to solve a different non-renormalizable model. Trust me, we're going to do that. We're going to discover the main physical principle that makes that soluble non-renormalizable model happen. We're going to apply that principle to covariant non-renormalizable models and extend that even into the renormalizable world. First, a little review. Let's take a space-time lattice. I've schematically indicated a lattice here. It has capital L points along one dimension, the same on another. Lattice spacing, a little bit of A. This could be a two-dimensional lattice, could be spatial. If I wanted to make it temporal as well, space-time lattice, you might think of a third dimension out here, similarly patched as that one is. K is a multi-integer label telling me the streets and avenues where that point live. Lattice spacing is baby A. Here is my Euclidean form of the lattice action for a covariant quantum field theory. This is the discrete form of the gradient term. K star means the nearest neighbor to K in the positive one direction and then summed, implicitly summed, because there's no space on the graph over those different directions. Here we are in n-dimensional space, by the way. Here's a quadratic mass term and a quartic coupling constant term. If I take that action and put it up e to the minus I to make the distribution, and I look at the generating function in terms of that, and then take the continuum limit from this kind of hypothesis of the situation in the greater than or five space-time dimensions, where is the non-renormalizability exists, it is known, been proved by Eisenman and Froehlich, that this comes out to be a strictly quadratic answer in the continuum limit. This is a non-faithful quantization. I have taken a non-free original theory, classically, quantized it by this method, and come up with a quadratic answer here, which corresponds to a Gaussian, which corresponds to a free theory, which does not correspond in the classical limit to the non-free quartic interaction I started with. In four dimensions, it has not yet been proved rigorously, but renormalization group and Monte Carlo have great suggestions to show that the same behavior exists here. So this is an example of a non-faithful quantization. In my opinion, it is an unsatisfactory point of view of quantization. Some people say, this is it. This is what it is, quantized. And therefore, it's trivial and blah, blah, blah. I say, can we do better? I'll pause. I'm reminded by Winston Churchill, a remark by him. When he first came to the United States in 1939, let us say, before the United States had entered the World War II, he traveled across the sea, and he was given an audience in front of our Congress, the representatives and senators together. And he started out in his grand voice, and we knew what he was here for. He wanted to get money to help his poor people. So he said, I have not come all this way to ask for money, applause, 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 for myself. Standing ovation, he got what he wanted. So I have not traveled all this way from Florida here today.
That was a pretty good wish.
To talk otherwise. Here. Okay, so we've just talked about possible mass modifications and coupling constant modifications, and they left the theory trivial. What about good old perturbation theory? Perturbation theory allows for a lot more contributions. So when n is greater than or equal to 5, the perturbation theory leads to infinitely many distinct terms of ever-increasing divergence, hence the label non-renormalizability. Now I want to convince you that that can be understood from a hardcore point of view. Here is a Sobolev type inequality. These are smooth functions involved in here, so this page is about the classical theory. On the left, we have our interaction term phi to the fourth, and that integral is raised to the 1/2 power to give it an overall scaling like phi squared. So if phi changed by a factor of 17, this would come out as 17 squared, just as the right-hand side does. On the right-hand side, we have the ingredients of the free term, the gradient term squared, and a mass-like term here. Now I'm telling you that this integral bounds this integral with a constant c, which can be worked out. And if n is less than or equal to 4 space-time dimensions, c is finite, and 4/3 does the trick. If n is greater than or equal to 5, c is infinite, meaning there are fields for which this term is infinite, while these two terms have a finite interval. So if you're making your classical action for this problem in 5 and more dimensions, these are the terms which would talk about the free theory. This is the term that would talk about the interaction term. And yet its very presence would restrict the set of functions that you could allow in the free theory. So that's what the hardcore is all about. Here, pictorially, we have our two ellipses again. Here, the green one, which is the free term, is inside the clear one, so that if you are free here, if that's finite, then you're automatically inside the big one, and that's finite. Over here, on the other hand, it's our former picture, which has the finiteness of the free theory here, finiteness of the interaction term here, but they're not. This one does not imply the other. That's this classical story. Let's do the same story from a quantum point of view. This time I take the same inequality, but I make it as a quotient. The reason for this is the following. In the functional integral, when you integrate over the fields in quantizing that way, you learn quickly enough that the fields is not supported on smooth functions, but on distributions rather, generalized functions. Now, this integral inequality is determined for smooth functions. That was all of interest to the classical analysis of it, as clear from the previous transparency. But I have a limit here of this quotient as I take a sequence of smooth functions and move them out toward a distribution. You know, every distribution can be approached as a sequence of smooth functions. Take a Gaussian that's getting narrower and taller. That's a delta sequence. Okay. So I can cover every possible point in the support of the distributions needed in the functional integral for such a theory. Again, if n is less than or equal to 4, which is the renormalizable theory according to quantum analysis, c is finite. On the other hand, when n is greater than or equal to 5, and we're dealing with a non-renormalizable theory according to quantum field theory, then c is infinite. So it's a qualitative difference between these two cases. The hardcore is doing its business, and the theory does not converge back, just as we saw in our toy model before. Okay. What is our strategy for divergences? Normally, we are reactive. We do a functional integral, then we do it by perturbation analysis. We have our beautiful Feynman graphs. We evaluate them. We see suddenly I got an infinity. I got to go back to the beginning. I have to put in a counter term here. I see what the counter term contributes. Oh, goody, goody. It cancels my infinity. I'm happy. I go out to the next term. I got a new infinity. Can my old counter term fix it? Perhaps. If not, I have to introduce a new one. That is a reactive approach. I'm going to suggest to you a proactive approach to dealing with infinities. Take the functional integral, which represents what we want, and go inside the integral before you do it, find the source of the infinities, and expunge it. Get rid of it. Now, there's an analogy to this business in homes located in a floodplain. Suppose I have a river, and I have homes or businesses nearby, and every few years, the flood overflows, the businesses get muddy and messy, and it costs money, and there's equipment to replace and everything. That is a reactive, and I go back to next year, it happens again. But I could take a proactive approach to that. If there's a few homes, all I need to do is move them up the hill, and if it's a city like Winnipeg, in this very country, they build a 45-kilometer canal around their city in you know, unoccupied land, and when the flood river wants to come down, they divert a good portion of it through the other one. So that's a proactive way to get rid of their problem. And yes, we're going to need to guess to remove the source. But you will be delighted with even your ability to guess the same answer. Okay, so here is to establish an inequality. Here's my distribution I want to make averages within, e to the minus lattice action. I have a particular term here. I want to take its average. I've written it as function of the fields on my lattice space-time over there, with a sum outside. That sum is over time separations, or different times. I'm going to restrict my attention to f of phi, which are all happening within a fixed spatial slice. If you'll permit me, this is my spatial, two-dimensional space, and out here are my temporal slices. And everything that I have, f of phi, can be described in this place, and then I just move it to different temporal slices as well. We'll see, that's the ones we need to evaluate. I raise that to the power p. This is just shorthand abbreviation for that. This is expanding out that power of p product. Here's a straightforward inequality, which permits me to bound this space-time average by a collection of purely spatial averages. This one is occurring at time t1. This one is occurring at time tp. But this is a distribution which is time translation invariant, as this action will tell you. And so all of these are the same. And it means that if I can bound this particular term at time 0, a time fixed time, then I win the bounding of this. And what does that look like? Well, for large enough lattice time, this can be represented as the ground state distribution. This is a unique ground state distribution expectation value of that particular quantity. So, summarize. If I can show you that the ground state expectation value of a certain quantity is finite, that's a spatial average, I will be able to tell you that, that not only is that finite, but its space-time average is finite. Don't forget I'm working in a finite space-time. Can be as big as the galaxy, but it's finite. One more time.
What is sigma tilde? Well, what is the tilde on the sigma zero?
Tilde is the fact that there's many sums here, sum over the time of this guy, the sum over the next time. It's just I can't write all those separate tildes. Of course. Absolutely right. Okay. So bear that in mind. When we come to average things in space-time averages, we're going to be really interested in focusing on that. Here is our next, after our intermission, our next effort. We're going to solve a non-renormalizable quantum scalar field. The classical action for that is given in this line. It is called the ultra-local scalar quartic interaction, phi dot squared minus a mass term, phi m0 squared phi squared, and a quartic coupling constant. There's a time dimension and one or more space dimensions here. Only a time derivative is here. So when I vary and get the equations of motion, I will get time-dependent equations of motion, but there will be no coupling between what happens at point X and the other point, the neighboring point. So the evolution is totally independent of the time. It only depends on the value, initial value at time t equals 0, say, and the initial derivative at time t equals 0. Now, I want to convince you that the classical free and pseudo-free theories are different in this case. If I'm dealing with the interaction present, then I must require that the fourth power of my functions integrate and be finite. If the lambda zero is strictly zero, as in the free theory, then I'm only requiring that phi squared be integrable. And you know, or you should know, each one of you, that there are plenty of functions for which this integral is finite and this integral is infinite. So the theory that I would solve with the interaction here has certain requirements on it. And as I take lambda to zero in that set of solutions, it would not encompass the set of solutions of the true free theory. The absence of a gradient, spatial gradient term here, leads automatically to a non-renormalizable theory for this guy. Well, normally in your propagator in momentum space, 1 over p vector squared plus m squared, think of it Euclidean space, so there's a p0 squared plus a p spatial squared plus m squared. Well, my p squared spatial is absent from that. So all the integrations over the momentum space are not softened by the presence in the propagator. So that's not renormalizable. If I limit this problem to a mass and coupling constant renormalization, as did Frohlich and Eisenberg, then the quantization is trivial, because of the central limit theorem here. Only things, every x is independent of every other x. If I discretize this as a lattice in x spatial, try to move forward and then take the continuum limit, the central limit theorem is going to give me a Gaussian answer. So this is, again, is a non-faithful quantization. So here we see in this model that we have a non-renormalizable theory which leads to a non-faithful quantization. Those are exactly the features we saw in the covariant case from before. If I can solve this model and find the cure, then the medicine that used to produce that cure could be transferred and given to those poor souls with the covariant non-renormalizable behavior. Okay. Question?
You set it up on a lattice. And then you were taking the lattice spacing to zero. But as you said, on the lattice, it's completely non, it's just a bunch of independent
Absolutely.
Particles in a quartic potential. So it seems to me there's going to be a difference from the case of lambda, of these theorems that you're talking about. Maybe I can...
What is different about it?
Maybe we should discuss it later, because I'm not sure. But I think that what goes on in those cases is that the coupling constant runs, and it reaches infinity, basically, at a finite lattice spacing. Whereas here, that won't happen. So
I'm simply saying that I don't have to go through that whole song and dance, forgive me, that you have espoused. All I need is a central limit theorem in this dramatically, kinematically simplified
model. Right, so I'm not questioning what you claim.
Yep.
But I'm just questioning the analogy.
Well, I'm just.
I think the problem is somehow worse in the case of
my analogy is only in these two words: non-renormalizable and non-faith. That's nothing deeper. We'll come to talk about things like you.
John, this is very interesting. Can I just see if I understood this correctly? You said that if you have a theory that has non-trivial interaction terms such as a phi to the four, then you may have that parts of it, like in this case for every x. Part of it may have ground states that are not Gaussian, like the ground state to the anharmonic oscillator is not Gaussian. However, if you throw them all together, then you end
up... And take the continuum limit.
And take the continuum limit. Then by the central limit theorem, you get something that is Gaussian,
Absolutely.
And therefore is then mistaken as a free theory. Because that's what the signature would also be for a free theory, that you have a Gaussian.
Well, that's because people haven't allowed the H-bar ambiguity enough freedom.
Yeah.
In probability, where you don't have H-bar ambiguities to help you, you are stuck with your original formulation. This will automatically go by central limit theorem to a Gaussian, period. But if I'm allowed to imply there are H-bar ambiguities in my quantization process, which we haven't yet talked about here, then perhaps I can overcome the Gaussian central limit theorem.
Related question on the central limit theorem. And there's some hypothesis about how rapidly the variance grows or something like
well,
that.
You,
I'm sure you couldn't tune
the
coupling constants.
In the next two or three slides, we're going to beat the central limit theorem. But accept it here if I insist only, as Frohlich and Eisenman did, on mass and coupling constant renormalization, I will definitely go to a Gaussian theory.
So there's no way you could tune them.
What?
There's no way you could adjust them as a function of A, the lattice spacing.
Nope.
That would avoid the central limit.
That's what they proved.
In this case.
Okay. So here is the ultralocal scalar field, trivially. Here is its classical Hamiltonian. Lambda 0 is going to be greater than or equal to 0. Here, again, you see a pseudo-free character.
because phi squared integrations and phi to the fourth integrations are quite different from each other. Okay, we're not worried about that now. In this slide, we're going to talk about the free theory. So strictly speaking, lambda 0 is going to 0. It's a bunch of independent harmonic oscillators. Our ground state distribution will be proportional to e to the minus m0 phi squared ds of x, the spatial integral. And the generator for that free field ground state distribution given by this integral, and it's just the Fourier transform, well, except for the I here, a Gaussian. It's again a Gaussian. So this is a possible answer for this model, the free theory, no surprises whatsoever, integral like that. Let's dig a little deeper into this example. We're going to look at the spatial lattice. So again, we had our periodic space-time lattice. Now we're going to focus on the spatial part. We're going to talk about the ground state distribution, and that occurs at a fixed time. So our k points are integers in the s dimensions here. Lattice spacing is little a. And I'm interested, here is my ground state distribution on the previous transparency, now on a lattice. I'm interested in the moments, mass-like moments, that I would get from this integral. And here is I sub p, p being the power of that term to integrate. Skip the next line. I tell you that the answer is of, given down here, it's of order of n prime over m0 to the power p. First off, what is n prime? N prime is the number of sites in the spatial lattice. L on each side, there's two sides over there. S is the number of dimensions of the spatial lattice. So L to the S, N prime, that's the number of spatial points. M0 comes in here for dimensions, if you like. Another way to see, or a way to see that it's N prime is very simple. Here is this term right here. Let's expand, let's let P equal 1. So that means there's this summation of terms here, which I bring outside. That's a summation over every point in the spatial lattice. There are n prime points there. So it is natural that I have an n prime multiplier times this integral because they're all equivalent, each one of them. If there's a p is power 2, that's square. There are n prime squared terms in that sum. And for very large n prime, all of those terms are basically equivalent. And it looks like that. Why am I interested in large n prime? Well, I want to go to the continuum limit. The continuum limit takes L toward infinity, therefore n prime to infinity as A goes to 0. And again, I'm telling you I'm in the galactic size. It's a finite limit. So A to the S times n prime wants to be a finite number. Okay, so this is going toward infinity in the continuum limit. That means all of these moments are diverging at different orders as we go along. Suppose I say M0 should be 1. Question?
Yes? You said that in the continuum limit, you take at the same time A to 0 and L to infinity?
That's the continuum limit.
That is the continuum and thermodynamic limit at the same time.
Because usually N A to 0 is continuum and L to infinity. N prime by itself, I would think, would be the thermodynamic limit. I don't have to go continuum to have a... I don't have to go... No. You're thinking that I have to go infinity, and that's not true. I can go... In this box, I can put L points along here and make my spacing smaller, and the limit of that would still be this size. Okay, here's my mass term. I'm going to do a perturbation in mass. So I will say mass is equal to 1 plus delta. Put that up here in this expression, 1 plus delta, expanded powers of delta, and you see that I have the first moment for M0 is given by the first moment for 1 plus a correction term of this exact kind, delta coefficient of I2, delta squared, I3, etc., coming from just a pure expansion of that in this exponent. Each of these terms is going to infinity. Each of these terms is going to infinity in the series more so than the first term. This term could be going to infinity. This term could be going to infinity. I could be happy if they're the same, but no, this one is going to the square of that. This is going to the cube of that. Something is bad. So n prime is the number of terms in that sum. N prime is causing us the illness. There it is. I can't reduce the number of terms in the sum.
because that's a regularization which will take me away from the field theory. What else can I do? Well, as a great man once said, change variables of integration. Start with that. So I'm going to introduce new variables. These are very much like your spherical coordinates, x, y, z. X, y, z, both, all of them equal r times something, r times something. So r is the sum of the squares of, it's r squared plus y squared plus z squared. And the coefficients of those things are direction cosines, angles, cosines of the angles, which live between plus and minus 1. And the sum of those squares, put you on the unit sphere, the sum of those squares is 1. So that's the variation I'm going to change. I'm going to take all of these variables and talk about the radius of all of them. And this eta k is going to be the direction cosine for each one of them. So the sum of the k squares is replaced by kappa squared. There it is, right there. Kappa squared to the p. There's the p. There's the kappa squared. It's replaced by kappa squared upstairs. I get a Jacobian with this. The Jacobian involves kappa to the n prime minus 1. Perfectly natural. When we do r cubed, we get r squared dr. This is my analysis of that. And I have the integration over the cosines left over. I can spell that out for you, but it's not interesting right now. So now I look at the answer, and I say, where did this terribly large number n prime come from? It came from that symbol right there. Because if I do a stationary phase approximation, including this term and that term, it says that kappa squared is proportional to n prime. Kappa squared proportional to n prime gives me an n prime to the p. It's as simple as that. If I could change that, but that is sacred territory. That comes from the measure. Every one of these phis runs from plus and minus infinity. This is now the only variable that sees infinity, zero to infinity. All of these etas live between plus and minus one. I brought the illness of the divergence, focused it on the kappa, and there it is right there, n prime minus one. Now, let's make a ridiculous, simple, stupid proposal. If I could change that n prime to a capital R, which was finite, then that would be a perfectly decent integral. In the continuum limit, I say R is still finite in the continuum limit. There, it's perfectly fine. This would not be infinity. This series would not have infinite terms. How can I change that sacred measure, where in Romania they would crucify you if you did such a thing?
Only in Romania, I think other places as well.
I can do it by a careful redesign of the free model. Instead of taking this as my free ground state, which we know it has to be, I'm going to start with a pseudo-free ground state. This picture was drawn for a classical, but it's true quantum mechanically. There is the quantum mechanical ground state over here, which is really far from the quantum mechanical free state. And I can't solve it, but I can guess what it might be. And I'm going to choose it to look like the regular ground state up in the exponent, but I'm going to put in a kappa to the minus n prime minus r, which is when it meets the measure factor, kappa to the n prime minus 1 is going to cancel that n prime and replace it with a capital R, which is finite. In other words, my postulate for the ground state distribution is going to go from this, which is the free theory, to the pseudo-free theory. But we don't know what that is, and I'm free to choose it. And I am putting in this as my postulate. Okay, here's kappa squared spelled out as the sum of those. And here's my R. It's going to be n prime times a to the s. That is the total volume in the spatial section. But that's a dimensional number. So I want to put in b, which is a nicely chosen. You can specify anyone you like. A b has length to the minus s to cancel that, to make that a dimensionless number, so it's allowed to go upstairs next to the n prime. And I'm going to insist that that's finite. Now the mass moments are finite. My God, what have I done? Let's pursue this guy a little further. Crazy idea as it is. Hello?
You had, on the last slide, you had psi ground G for ground state, I guess. And then you had...
This one?
Yes.
What's your question?
Where does it come from? Is that an ansatz, or is it computed from the path integral? Or?
This thing is computed from here. It says, if I put this, if I put that term in, it will kill the unwanted term in the measure and replace it with capital R.
So it's an ansatz.
It's an ansatz. Of course it's an ansatz.
The I is for ansatz.
That gives it too much credit. Okay.
But then is the idea that it can be generated through use of an ordering ambiguity?
What?
It's the idea that it can be generated through an ordering ambiguity.
It will turn out to be true. That will turn out to be true. Right. Okay. Now, so instead of the free ground state, which is here, I'm going to put in the free ground state plus the modification, which takes that capital N prime by itself and replaces with R, capital R, finite, which I have chosen this to be my R. And I put it in quotation marks because all I have said that this was a proportionality story. I haven't yet clarified how it's going to come in. The next line does that. It reminds you that the ground state distribution for the ultra-local model is independent at every spatial point. So the only possible way to have this integral come out for this is to have a product outside, independent of every spatial point, of an integral involving a one-dimensional term. And this is the power phi to the 1 minus BASTN, which appropriately, remember, every phi is proportional to kappa. Put a kappa here, raise it to that power, and then multiply it by itself n prime times, you'll come up exactly with the term that I put in there. So here is the modification, which has modified this free theory into a pseudo-free theory, and has achieved this goal. Okay. I want to go from this line to this line. Notice this line has phi a to the s, and there's no a to the s here. There's no A to the S here. I figure there's no A to the S here, but there is an A to the S here. I have to go from this line to this line, and I have to do that by a mass renormalization. My M0 is not going to be a 1 anymore. It's going to get small. So it is proportional to a fixed finite mass parameter times something which is going towards small in the... I can explain that to you later, but yeah. One more time.
By putting this kappa.
I did the kappas before. That was this. That was this. This level.
Aren't you just introducing some coupling between the spatial?
Right,
it looks like you're introducing some coupling between the spatial planes.
Yeah, you would think so. You would think so.
So you can no longer write it as a product of one dimension.
I actually said it was proportional to the kappa. I didn't say how the etas entered in, and the etas can enter in such a way that is not spread out between two points. And that's exactly this one. That's exactly this line. Does everybody see that this has kappa to the n prime minus r in the denominator that comes from here? And of course it has etas downstairs as well. So it's not summation kappa all by itself squared and left of that. That would indeed spread out everything over the whole spatial portion. Okay. Okay, to go from this line.
We agree that this integral has an eta in the denominator.
Say again?
This integral has an eta in the denominator, yes?
Yes.
And the etas, in order to define them, you need to use all the points.
Yes.
The etas themselves are not locally defined. They use all the phi in all the points, phi 1 to phi k.
What about them? What are you saying? They're not locally defined? What does that mean?
It means that in order to be so eta k, it is phi divided by the sum over all the points of phi k
squared.
Square root of the sum, blah, blah, blah.
Yes,
so
sure.
This is not something, this is not a local quantity. It's not something which associates. It's
not a well-defined quantity?
It is not local. It involves all the points.
No.
It's not factored over k.
Phi equals kappa times a to k. I don't care whether you call this local or not. A to k is the local cosine. I take my radius vector here, I have my x and y coordinates down here, and I have the angle down here, theta x, theta y. That's a local statement about the direction of the radius vector in two dimensions. And
yeah, but theta k, if I try to define, I make the change of variables from phi k to kappa and theta k.
Yes, yes, yes.
My formula for theta k involves phi at many points. Theta k is a function of phi. It involves phi at all points, through kappa, because kappa itself it involves phi at all points. So it's not only the kappa which is involves all the points, also the theta involves all the points.
Let's do it in three dimensions. Here is z, here is theta, this is my vector r, here's my x and y, which has another thing. Z is equal to r cosine theta. What do I need to know about x and y at all to find this theta? Nothing. It is in a cone, which is acceptable for all possible thetas, at angle theta from the zenith, from the z-axis.
Local question. Not needing to know what's happening in the x-y plane.
No, I'm sorry to be...
Proof by intimidation.
And only needing three dimensions.
Okay. The point is that there's what's a K-integral.
We are at the heart of this talk. Understanding this is primarily... is primary. Okay, so this is the proper redistribution of that hypothetical kappa, which preserves the independence of the degrees of freedom, as they must be. I want to get rid of the ASs here, and I have to do that by a mass renormalization, and I do that, and therefore now this has AS squared. I can eliminate that here, and now I can take, I've added and subtracted one, it's convention, and I take my continuum limit, and I get a reasonable-looking answer. It is, again, statistically independent for what happens at every x. Now, there's something called the theory of infinite divisibility in stochastic processes. Infinite divisibility is a thing I can apply to this very model. And it says only Gaussian and Poisson distributions emerge from this theory. We have, by our crazy guess, stumbled into how the Poisson distributions come into this theory. This model was solved 40 years ago. Not by using perturbation theory and not by regularizing anything. And in the solution of those 40 years ago, this was the answer given here for the pseudo-free theory applicable to this problem. We have stumbled onto that by this ridiculous principle of changing the measure so that this n prime goes to a finite factor. Let's go back one and say to ourselves, well, here it is. This is what we're doing to change it. This is the free theory for the ultra-local theory. Everything's independent here. But you remember what a free theory for a covariant theory might look like as well. It would also be Gaussian. There would be a double sum. There would be a phi k and a phi l with some matrix in between. It too would be Gaussian, however, as this is Gaussian. However, the evil that we wanted to take away from this problem was even more fundamental. It was in the measure. And that measure didn't care what theory it was going to talk about. It only cared about the coordinate change of variables from the Cartesian phi k's to the miraculous hyperspherical coordinates, kappa and eta. Okay.
Well, can I have a question?
What?
The partition function of the user theory.
Yes, what?
Do Winston. The partition function of the user theory.
My what?
The partition function.
Partition function?
Is the initial integral you wrote.
Yes.
You can write it itself as a product over points of something associated to the points, yes?
Yes.
So its ground state will be a product over points of something associated to points.
Yes, yes. Then what?
So this ground state doesn't look at all like that.
It is, my friend. Look. Oh, no, of course it doesn't look here. This is only the clumsy plot along the way. Here is where it looks like a product, because it's the integral of things of a local function. There's no derivatives of the h up here. There's no x, h of x kissing an h of y or anything else. They are all separate integrals.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but my point is the following, is that something which definitely was not independent on the slide before, it cannot become independent here. And
Joe, just a minute, my friend. This is true that it's proportional. It is true. There's a lot of eta's going in here to make it a local product, but I didn't need to spell that out for you on this slide, did I? It's not equal. There's lots of eta's here, which would end up making that thing local.
product of local things. Just like it turned out to be on the next slide when I said, let's get this guy out of the quotation marks and see what the model can handle. The model can only handle independent distributions, and that's what I have now. Yet I have the right power of kappa. Okay. Okay, we were supposed to go back. Okay, so here we were. I said a true free theory, covariant free theory, has a phi k, phi l, to this quadratic and phi, and there's a matrix in between. But this is the, at a more fundamental, a primitive, more fundamental. So I'm going to use the same trick. It has a romantic name, mashing the measure. mashing the measure. I'm going to use the same trick in the covariant world, you'll see. Okay, of course, I will have to keep this thing, again, like the free theory or something like that in the covariant world. We'll come to that. Okay, so here we are, Poisson. We hit a jackpot. We got it in a simple way. Trust me, 40 years ago, the derivation knew nothing about this. It based on symmetry alone. And this is a new insight into how to do this. Okay, we can have other ground states, not only the ground state of the pseudo-free model, but a general ground state. Put in an interaction. There's a ground state there. Has to look like this because it cannot vanish, a ground state distribution. I'm going to maybe have to modify that slightly, but... Yes, sir.
Before you go to the non-ultra-local theory.
Yeah.
See? You talked about two things. You changed the measure, but at some point you also talked about the ground state. Are those two independent things, or we can just forget about the ground state? And
say what? So you don't understand what?
In the way we arrived at your pseudo-free theory.
Yes.
I can understand you've changed the measure of integration.
I didn't change the measure. I put in a new factor which influenced the measure, if you will, like that. Some people accuse this of dimensional regularization. No, not at all. I said
this. I wasn't doing that.
No, thank you.
But you did change, you did modify the measure, you mashed the measure.
I mashed the measure.
But did you do something further? Because at some earlier point you were talking about the ground state. That was just the motivation for changing
just
the measure?
Just the motivation. How did I find those infinities? I found the infinities let's go back a little bit. this ground state here, we evaluated that, we saw those terms gave us infinity, but if we had had this factor inside there, then it would have changed that n prime to a finite factor r. How do I get it put in? I get it put in by saying that this was my free theory, but I'm going to postulate an entirely new pseudo-free theory to which all the interacting other theories will be connected, you'll see, that has this feature. And this feature I can do, if you didn't like it there, skip that line and go directly to this line. It's got the right kappa behavior to do exactly what I want. Okay, time to move on. Here's the ground state proposal, ground state distribution, for an interacting theory. So there's a lambda phi to the fourth and anything else you want. I'm going to try to put in this term as a modifier and see what happens. And finally you see what the coordinates look like. Kappa squared sums to these guys and one sums to all those direction cosines. In the ultra-local case, the ultra-local symmetry will clean this up and make it look proper. Now, here's something you might be more comfortable with. What is the lattice action for this problem? Here is the temporal discrete derivative squared term. Here is the quadratic mass term. Here is the quartic interaction term when that term is present. And here is the counter term. The counter term necessary to produce that 1 over kappa to the messy, messy power. It involves the inverse square field. But I've already got your permission to talk about that when we talked about y of q having possible beta equal minus 2. You didn't fight then, you can't fight now. It's proportional to h bar squared, and the symbol f here is independent of the coupling constant. It doesn't depend on lambda 0. So when lambda 0 goes to 0, that is still there. That is the pseudo-free solution. And all of these are continuously connected, and there is a question.
How come, can you have the same time, all the sums there are finite? So the sum over 5k to the fourth and the 1 over 5k squared and so on and so forth? Because you would seem that, you know, if you go to
This is a finite lattice. I say it for the 12th.
Yes, but when you go to the continuum beam,
it works. It trust me, it works.
You find field configurations for which all these terms are finite.
Say again?
So are there field configurations for which all these terms are finite? Like, you know, also 5, 4 and 5 to the minus 2, both of them are integral?
Well, you might ask yourself, I think you're asking the following way. Why don't I have double dots assigned to this, Rick ordering of this term? Because the presence of this thing has changed the proper ordering of multiplication. It has taken it from Rick ordering, subtractive multiplication, to operator product expansion ordering. It has changed it to a multiplicative renormalization, and indeed, the very term here where this is needed is because this is a phi squared. A phi squared is a multiplicative renormalization. There it is. That is the multiplication factor in front of it to render that a finite quantity in the field. And in that sense, it has allowed the ASs to disappear. So it's because of the fact that in this new set of variables, it's no longer the Wick ordering that's relevant. Okay. So this is a local potential. It disappears when h bar goes to zero. And all of these terms, literally, will be finite terms because of the multiplicative renormalization.
What is S?
I invite you, as an exercise, if you take e to the minus x squared over 2 as a ground state, and you take minus d2 by x squared plus potential, you want it to be a ground state. So you take it and look like this. And maybe you're a fanatic about your factors of 2. Like that. And then you work this out. This will be a minus 1/2 d2 x squared plus 1/2 x squared minus 1/2. And that is your nasty zero-point energy, which when you put this for infinite number of degrees of freedom, causes divergence. On the other hand, if you take this as your ground state, which I am advertising to you, and gamma is very close to 1/2, is less than or equal to 1/2, not equal, less than 1/2. You've seen that in the 1 minus b, this kind of thing here. It differs from 1 by that. And you carry that derivative out, you find your potential is equal to 1/2 x squared plus h bar squared. I'm going to call it 3/4. That's not true. It's this number here, which is less than 3/4, over x squared. And yes, there is a zero-point energy. But what is it? It is minus 1/2, 1 minus 2 gamma. And as gamma gets close to 1/2, that gets small. This thing is proportional to BA to the S. And so a summation of these, which is an N prime multiplication of it, is a finite number. Changes your ground state energy story. Operator product expansion. You had a question? Your hand was waving. You won't do it again. Okay. So, if you like, we could have started with that. That is our counter term. It doesn't involve lambda zero. It's not. If it did involve lambda zero and vanish when lambda zero would do, it would go back to the free theory. But this is not that. This is a collection of interacting theories continuously connected to a pseudo free theory when lambda zero goes to zero, and that's the definition of that term. Question there. Okay.
When you put this into the path integral, are you supposed to use that d phi over phi type measure, or are you supposed to use the usual measure?
You use, if you have to correct, you have to put in h bar corrections into the path integral. That would work. Yeah.
No, I mean, in your previous ultra-local version, you had it, when you wrote down the continuum theory, if I'm not mistaken, you had a d phi over phi, over absolute value of phi, in the measure. Am I remembering it wrong?
That is the wave function. That is this part. This part has led to the 1 over x squared term, which you're now seeing here.
Can you go?
Come on.
Okay.
If I take any power, like R to the L, and in three dimensions, when I play with spherical harmonics, I have R to the L times of e to the minus, blah, blah, blah. Take a derivative, I get an L, and then a, okay, this will be a minus L. L plus 1. That could have been L plus 1, sorry. L plus 1, sorry for that. And then I get this over R squared.
Right.
That becomes the potential that goes with this particular modification of the waveform.
Right. But I thought when you wrote the pass integral down, you also had modified the measure of the pass integral.
Where did I ever?
Write
the path integral down? We've never yet written a path integral for this thing. What we've written down are integrals of the ground state distribution. The ground state distribution certainly defines the ground state. The ground state certainly defines the Hamiltonian operator, and the Hamiltonian operator certainly defines this.
But
the ground state distribution has this power x to the gamma, whereas this guy comes up with an inverse x squared.
Same.
Okay? Yes, Jim? Yes?
Is there going to be a Feynman rule for that?
One more time.
Is there going to be a Feynman rule for phi to the minus 2 term?
One more time.
Is there going to be a Feynman rule for that?
Question.
No, you cannot.
Feynman rules require to have a Gaussian free theory, period. We're not going to do that. We can't do that. We'll talk about it a little bit later what to do. Okay, here's the ground state in a general interacting theory. It's not the simple quadratic it need be, but it has to have this singularity here. Indeed, the normalization integral, which wants to be 1, has to be an incipient divergence. As this little term went to 0, it would diverge. We had to have that incipient divergence to have the normalization coefficient b a to the s in our chain of characterizations, which then became our incremental measure x to the power s. Okay, so for the ultralocal, we require that divergence. Okay, so just fact. Here we go. We're now ready to apply this idea to the covariant world. What did we find? We found that we want to change the measure from this to something finite, and we'll keep it the same in the covariant world. R, a finite number, matching the measure. There it is. For the covariant models, unlike the ultralocal, we don't want the divergence at phi equal to 0. We didn't need that BA to the S to come up in the exponent like that. In fact, it must be avoided. We have to do something to change that. Well, here's the idea. Here is the integral of a one-dimensional variable over a finite interval, plus minus 1, so it goes through the origin, d phi over phi squared to the half. This is my symbolic part for the square of this when this is 1/2. Forget this. That's taken care of by the fact that we're doing it on a little interval. So that's a non-integrable singularity. We needed that. But for the covariant case, we don't want that. So we're going to substitute for that a sum of several variables. You'll see how that goes. And now if I integrate over that p-dimensional square, or hypercube if you like, that's finite. This is an integrable singularity. That is not. Okay. So here we go. We're into the covariant world now. The phi k squared, which stands beneath the ground state, as a product, is going to be changed. It's going to be, this is again, ansatz, lovely word, ansatz. We're going to change it by taking its value and its nearest neighbor spatial values. Here is an example of a two-dimensional place in the lattice. Here is the point K in the middle. This point is nearest in the left sense. This is nearest in the right sense. This is nearest in the up sense. This is nearest in the down sense. So I take these four together with that one, making 5, and I average those 5 together. In the continuum limit, those points become arbitrarily close. And points arbitrarily close in a covariant theory in which the gradients determine who's nearby and who doesn't and what the fields are like, these guys will really become like their neighbors. But at the moment, before we take that limit, we take this lattice form and we put our regular proposal upstairs, and we have this summation of these guys downstairs. This is not an average over the lattice by any means. It's just a simple little notation, because it fits small space.
that says I take the point in the middle, k squared, and I average over the nearest neighbors. If I'm in five or six spatial dimensions, then I have more points to average. And that's my normalization criteria. Again, I do it in such a way that kappa, our friend, still has the same bloody power as we need to mash the measure. Here, finally, is the proposal, lattice proposal, for the covariant theories. Here is the space-time difference form of the gradient squared Euclidean space. Here is the quadratic mass term, the quartic coupling constant, and our interaction term looks very much like what we had before. There's a little complicated here mess, you don't worry about that, telling you how you derive these terms. But it depends on this 1 over phi summation squared derivatives, and you'll see on the next slide exactly what FK looks like. So here are those little factors we've been talking about before, which are not quite one, but nearby. J is a set of numbers which are 1 over this number when the point L and K are the same, or when L is a nearest neighbor. Again, in two-dimensional example, K and L would be the same in the middle. Here are their nearest nearby spatial neighbors. So that's an average of the 1 over 5 in this particular case for S equal 2. So that's what the J's are. The J's simply stand for this expression here. And when I take the derivatives, the analog of this statement for the field theory story, I will create the potential due to this extra term, and it looks like this. Okay, that's a mess. But this is phi over phi squared. So that's 1 over phi raised to that power. That's 1 over phi squared. Phi squared over phi to the fourth, that's 1 over phi squared. 1 over phi squared. This is homogeneous in 1 over phi squared again. So the question earlier, could it come by a, by a ordering ambiguity? And the answer is yes. You can take your classical theory with pi squared, momentum squared, and put some functions of the field in the numerator and the denominator, distribute them carefully, and you would come out with this particular form for the counterterm. Again, this counterterm does not depend on lambda 0. As lambda 0 goes to 0, you go back to the pseudo-free theory. Again, that little picture applies right there. Okay, again, even though that has some nearby points involved, which is perfectly natural in a covariant case, this has a local potential. When I let the continuum limit go to 0, this is a complicated but nevertheless a local potential. Funny way to do it, but you couldn't guess this to begin with, in my view, but you can guess the other term. So here are our basic ingredients. We start with the postulate that the ground state looks like that. We insist there's going to be a Hamiltonian which kills that ground state. This is the general interaction story. Our Hamiltonian then is going to be chosen to be two derivatives, spatial gradients here, an energy constant, quadratic mass term, quartic interaction term, plus this counter term that we just saw on the previous transference. We're going to convert this Hamiltonian into a lattice action. That simply amounts to changing this term basically into another term like that. Put that in my integral for the generating function and evaluate those things. Here is the coupling, the field strength renormalization appearing for the first time, z to the minus 1/2. Okay. Now, the slides have been busy. This is busier yet. Let's look at it slowly. This is the generating function, S of H. It is the same thing we had on before. We have four terms, A, B, C, D, up in the exponent. A is our field strength renormalization times the source term. B is our quadratic mass term. C is our quartic lambda term. And D is our finite derivatives term plus the counter term. I'm going to make a power series expansion in A, B, and C, leaving only D up in the exponent. A, B, and C then are the source term, the mass term, and the quartic interaction term. I want to prove that each term in this series is finite. Notice that there is no Wick ordering in these things. These things are going to be finite, well-defined operators by themselves. A, B, C. So I can bound A, B, C in this average, in this sense, by A to a big enough power, B to a big enough power, C to a big enough power, where that big enough power is the sum of those three numbers, K, L plus M. So if I can determine that A all by itself, terms by themselves will be finite, B all by themselves, C will all be finite, then I can tell you that A, B, C to arbitrary powers is finite. Okay, this doesn't look like your ordinary field theory, I tell you. Now, I cannot solve my proposed Hamiltonian with the counterterm for the true ground state. I cannot get an analytic solution. But I can get an approximate solution. The approximate solution is correct for large field powers, which is basically the free term, and it's correct for small values of the field, which is correct for the F term. And there's a missing term here, which is intermediate to that, but I do know its field dependence, its functional dependence, on the parameter little a. Here's our change of coordinates. Here is an integral that we dealt with previously in terms of this approximate wave function. What does it look like today? It looks like this up in the exponent because of that term. Here's the kappa with the corrected power of n prime coming from the denominator. Here's the denominator with all the eta factors. You might like to think that these eta factors would diverge when a goes to zero because they're in the denominator. But they come as a sum of terms. And remember, we talked about that simple 1 over sum squared. It was an integrable singularity. So these turn out to be integrable singularities at the normalizable wave function. That's nothing special. In fact, that power could go beyond a half and still be finitely integrable. Okay, so there's nothing dangerous in here at all. There's no capital N prime, which is going to kill us. Now, how do I choose these constants? How do I choose Z? How do I choose the bare mass? How do I choose the coupling constant? I'm going to choose them in order to ensure that each term, this was called capital A, average to the power 2p. This was called B to the power p. This is called C to the power p. I want to choose it so that those three terms are well defined, and that can be done, we talked about this before, if I can show that the same thing is true at, for the spatial averages in the ground state distribution. And the ground state distribution can be approximated in order to evaluate that term. I do one of those calculations for you. So here is the ground state issue. We want to make this guy finite. Here is the integral in which to do it. Again, the kappa behavior is fine. This has a decent continuum limit because this is called capital R, and that does not diverge. This will go to zero, and then 1/2 is certainly integrable. In order to make progress, however, I have to tell us what capital A as a matrix behaves, how it behaves in terms of little a. Little a is the lattice spacing here. In order to get the derivative guys going, it has to be like a to the power minus s minus 1 in that power. Minus s minus 1 up in the power. Put that together with this a, that gives me an a to the s minus 1, either the plus s minus 1. You'll see that that's right here. What about capital N prime? How does the capital N prime dependence? We have agreed that the summation of all the a to k squared equals 1. So that means a single a to k squared average has to be 1 over n prime, because they're all homogeneous, and their sum has to be 1. So that bounds what the cross term can be by the Schwarz inequality. I'll give that the best it can do, is 1 over n prime. There are two sums, that's the n prime squared, so I get an n prime there. So this is n prime to the little a to the positive s minus 1. Change variables. I bring that outside the integral. Just kappa squared, as I like to tell my students, emits a 1 over n prime times a to the s minus 1 that cancels it here and makes it come out here. Anyway, those factors come outside the integral, and what is left is an integral involving e to the minus kappa squared, no longer depending on little a, This term does not sensibly depend on little a. I'll set it to zero. This term depends on capital R. There's no other little a in the problem. Now we can take the thermodynamic limit, letting n prime going to infinity, and this integral will be well-behaved. It can pretend like it's all on a lattice. These factors, however, I must fix. So I now decide what m0 should look like. M0 squared should look like an n prime times a finite factor so that it can cancel this particular n prime. The a to the sp will cancel by itself. So I have m0 squared looks like an a to the minus 1. So it has to have an a to the minus 1. With these two terms, these three terms, I have made this such that this would have a meaningful continuum limit, this coefficient. What is Q? I want this to have the same dimensions as this, m squared and m0 squared to have the same dimensions. So I introduce another. It could be the s root of the little b that we introduced before. It's another parameter with length, one over length measurement to cancel that term. Anyway, choosing m0 squared there makes this into a finite integral. No, what do you call it? No normal ordering, continuum limit. Still bounded in a finite galaxy-side world. These are the three coefficients. We just talked about how m0 worked. This is lambda 0. This is z, how that comes out. If you know your renormalization theory, z times m0 squared and z squared times lambda of 0 are good quantities here. These are all finite in the continuum limit. I'm rushing here for you. Okay, renormalization group people. They say, oh, Wilson has, this is a quoting a referee's report. He may be in the audience. Wilson did it all, Friday the 4th, it's all free. I claim Wilson did not do it all. He didn't study 1 over phi squared with a proper coefficient. So I claim that the ultra-local already gives a contradiction to that kind of statement. So it's okay. What about supersymmetry and superstrings? Wonderful ideas. They're good for some things. I don't think they're relevant here. Supersymmetry is designed to cancel divergences. I don't need them. I went to the source and took that source out. Effective theory. Well, you see people who do their fight of the fourth theory and get a free theory, they say, apologies, but there's some other theory waiting for that to be part of, to be well-defined. Perhaps. For the weak interactions, it worked out. Perhaps. But I say it's much more likely to be a non-faithful quantization, and you can do better by taking advantage of the H-bar ambiguity. I've been asked about fermions. If I can do it for scalars, why can't I do it for fermions? Well, it's under investigation. The fermion ultra-local model was solved 37 years ago. So that's being reinvestigated now to see if it can be made here. Now, we're almost done. Extension to other models. So we've been talking about the non-renormalizable case. For n less than 5, the classical pseudo-free and free theories coincide. Remember, we had that C was 4/3. That was the statement that it bounded the interaction term. But there's nothing preventing us from keeping the same h-bar squared term that we put in for the non-renormalizable theories. I'm going to extend it down. It's a different quantization. It is not the typical one, but it's different. And are there any advantages? I claim there are two. First of all, the local products come from the operator product expansion rather than normal ordering. I remind you, and if you haven't thought about this for a long time, you should, that phi x squared weak ordered is not a positive quantity. It's real, but it's not positive. And you go around and ask any 10-year-old you meet in the street and said, you've been using the square of something which is not positive. And they will say to you, you're out of your brain. Operator product squares are positive. I think that carries more physics. Furthermore, all divergences, even in the low dimensions, disappear. Frequently asked questions. Is it a different theory? I say no. For the same reason we allowed beta equal minus 2, that 1 over field squared is just a regularization term for the kinetic energy, as Akeem was quite well to point out. As the coupling constant goes to zero, they say, where is my free theory? I say it's because of the hard core, it can never come back. Now, how do you calculate? Monte Carlo. Now, I've been waiting all day today for my Monte Carlo man to send me pictures. And they didn't come. So I can't show you the pictures, which I haven't seen myself. This is that fresh, it would have been nice to see. Which support this or possibly say you're out of your crazy. You're incredible. I expect them to say positive things, but I can't show them to you today. Maybe in a published version, you get to see it later. And finally, application. Okay, where can it go? I could say it works in any space-time dimension and any field power for the scalar field. You might say, okay, what about an interaction e to the phi to the fourth? I don't want to talk about that. I'm talking about these guys, okay? Principle may work for quantum gravity. Cosmological term could be the counter term. Now, I'm not the first person to say that, but it could be the only scalar that I could add as a extra potential with a suitable coefficient to play the same role as my 1 over phi squared. You say the cosmological constant term doesn't diverge, like what 1 over phi squared does diverge. And I say to you, use not the g mu nu lower indices as your variable, but use the upper indices, g mu nu upstairs. So then that becomes lambda divided by the determinant of that g. So they could go to infinity. Okay. Almost. Add, here it is, in three short lines. Add a fixed counter term proportional to h bar squared. Scales of the kinetic energy. Determine the parameters by self-consistency in the continuum limit. That's what we did for z, m0 and lambda 0. And it leads to a divergent-free perturbation formulation about the pseudo-free model, which contains the counter term, not the free model. Too bad. Sorry for so long.
I have to run. To another appointment.
Okay, thank you for your.
Great, John.
Thanks so much.
Question. My question is, are you really seriously changing the ground state of a harmonic oscillator to nothing?
Am I doing what?
Are you seriously changing the ground state of the harmonic oscillator to that?
No, of course not. I mean, this is a kind of an analog to that statement.
Yeah.
But I'm simply saying to you that what potential applies to this ground state, that's the harmonic oscillator.
Yeah.
What potential V applies to this ground state, and that is this problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So basically you're saying that whenever I measure you took the harmonic oscillator.
By the way, I should put in an H bar coefficient to this energy.
Yeah, but whenever initially you thought you had the harmonic oscillator, there's actually this other term also that you didn't.
That is my secret ingredient, distilled from Chilean mine, where 33 people are still struggling to get out, to change the ground state into a ground state which removes the source of the divergences.
Yes, it's not, I understand, but you would think that there would be other tests of this ground state in...
Other tests?
I mean, there will be tests that show that the ground state of harmonic oscillator...
It's not the harmonic oscillator. It's not the true.
It's changing the potential. It's changing the potential.
You would be interested to know what is the spectrum of this Hamiltonian with this extra term, okay?
Yeah, I understand you're doing that. But my point is, for example, when you look at inflation, people calculate... whether you predict a Gaussian power spectrum, or Gaussian initial condition or non-Gaussian, and then everything is consistent with Gaussianity. But what you're writing down there is not Gaussian because of this x to the 1/2. So does this mean that this is already ruled out because we see Gaussian microwave background?
Because this involves an h-bar correction. H-bar over 2 ln of x takes care of that. In fact, well, there's an H bar here, so that is even gone. So this is an H bar correction to this, and I'm telling you that is a freedom available to you in your quantization.
Yeah, that would be a small correction for classical theory, but for ground state, it's a huge correction.
Good.
I want it to move from here to here. So I want a big curve.
And my point is that there are people who claim they're observing the ground state of scalar field theory when you look at cosmic microwave background. And that seems to be Gaussian. So that
But are they looking at, do they look at log? They look at just phi cube, phi force.
Yeah.
But this is not of this type. It's a.
Well, that's weird.
It's not really in the class.
So the point is, that you're saying if it's not Gaussian, then the 4-point functions are not trivial functions of the 2-point function.
Right.
And when you check in the constant microwave background, they are checking for whether the 4-point functions or 3-point functions, whether they are simple products of 2-point functions.
Yeah, exactly.
So
they're
checking for Gaussianity, and so far no evidence for non-Gaussianity.
That's right. So you're very close to Gaussian, and it seems to me that this is very far from Gaussian.
This is very mild.
I don't think it's mild, because
it's a log correction to the potential. It's not a...
You'll be interested to know what makes the Gaussian...
The original correction is not huge.
The spectrum of this guy...
It depends on how much that's sent.
The spectrum of this term, with this term, is not unlike what you find if it arose from a three-dimensional problem. A three-dimensional harmonic oscillator problem in which L was chosen to be some of these numbers. That would be a spectrum of equal spacing. And this guy here in one dimension has a spacing of equal dimension. The only thing that's different is that the...
You think it's equal spacing, even?
Which one?
This potential.
Yeah, absolutely. What is different? Well, here, let me tell you what the...
The degeneracy is different.
So only the degeneracy is change. It's the same spectrum as a non-equal spectrum.
Okay, so here's the spectrum. Here's another way. I promised you this too, but I didn't come around to this yet. Here is the... Let me take lambda over x to the fourth and set lambda to zero. What do I get? I get Dirichlet boundary conditions imposed on this differential operator plus that. So I have the discrete spectrum of the harmonic oscillator but doubled. So instead of being 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, suitably subtracted, this becomes 0, 2, 4, 6, 8, suitably subtracted. So if you're talking about a spectrum like Planck, which needed an equal value of its spacing in order to come out Gaussian looking, this would deliver it. I don't know what the covariance spectrum is going to look like, so don't take me there, but this is for the harmonic oscillator. So yes, sir.
Well, I have a question, so, about, because here you were, I mean, in fact, about Lorentz covariance.
Yeah.
Because what you're doing here, in the way you're presenting, is that you're modifying property of the Lorentz covariance of the ground states, right? Because in your description,
here is the action. The lattice action. That is the thing where we look for covariance. We don't look at the ground state. The ground state can have lots of wide distribution. The free particle, relativistic free particle, has lots of long-range interactions in its ground state. Trust me.
I'm confused because your averaging is a spatial average.
Ah, but
and your ground state
and now take the continuum moment. Tell me where this potential will differ in the continuum limit from a local potential.
Can you go back? It's a bit confusing because there's too much notation, but essentially I would imagine that your potential, go back where you were. The potential F.
Yes, yes, yes.
F of phi contains only spatial derivatives.
No spatial derivatives, no. It contains averages over nearby spatial squares.
Yeah, but that's the thing, it treats space and time differently. That's what I'm saying.
On the lattice. Come on, you have full rotational invariance on the lattice? You don't expect it.
I'm just saying the ground, I mean, have you looked, I'm just, you know, have you looked at the issue of covariance? That is the state you get.
Let's talk about the free theorem.
I'm just not sure if your K are spatial or time-like. I'm confused about your notation. So, but clearly the state you get you know, in the vacua, you're modifying the state, and you're modifying the property of Lorentz covariance.
This is the free field. You agreed to that on the last...
K is the summation of what? Space-time, space...
One space dimension?
K is what? Space or time? Or both?
Okay,
or,
okay. Or space and time. Space and time.
Space and time.
So that's the sum over the star directions and the sum over K.
And the stars are in space and time?
One space, one time.
Yes.
Or in five space and one time. Okay. Here's my field for the master, right? I now ask you, if I put in this field, before I square it, that is reaching outside the lattice, outside your cone. But in the continuum limit, they would be the same.
Yeah, but you're doing something about the continuum. So what I'm asking is that maybe, it's a question, I would bounce back the question to you. Are you sure, you know, because in the continuum limit, you're randomizing things in a given way. So I would say you have to kind of look at what happens to Lorentz covariance.
I have asked an expert in lattice gauge theory, is this a crime to average over these points? And they said, take any finite number you want. It will lead to the same continuum.
But you're changing the continuum limit, you agree? That,
no,
so
I'm approaching it in a different order, different way. Come on, it's just a different sequence.
Well, I don't know, you could look at it. That is, the ground. If you take the point of view of the ground state, once you get a finite, you know, things you modify the property of covariance. So you want to be sure that in the limit, or maybe that's one of the effects of your modification, is that there's a modification of Lorentz covariance, I don't know. Have you checked? I mean, I'm just saying, it's not obvious to me. Right?
I think you know everything I know at this point.
Is it important to you to use that particular combination? Or
one more time?
Is it important to you to use that particular combination?
Because it came from this particular combination.
So could you write me this action in the continuum?
Summation of these guys underneath.
Can you write?
Yes. It came from this ground state, where this was a sum of squares. I could have put a sum of fourth powers and taken another square root. I don't think it's fundamentally different. I could have averaged over 36 points instead of 5 points.
Can you write down the classical continuum Lagrangian? Maybe that's what I'm asking.
The classical?
Continuum Lagrangian.
Well?
Where you don't have to do the average.
So, this would become a gradient term. Where's my bond? This would become the space-time gradient.
Yeah.
If you want to go into real-time versus imaginary time, where's that? This will become those two terms naturally. And if you're going to let me take the classical limit, then h bar should go to zero.
No. But
fine. Okay.
I'm happy to believe
keep h squared, and this is 1/5 squared. Because in the continuum limit, all of those points that I average over would come back again.
It's just 1/5 squared.
Okay. Well, the ground state. You know.
I have a question about your v there.
What?
About your v. The potential
you have
there. 1/x squared is not self-adjoint. It's symmetric, but not self-adjoint. It does not have a unique self-adjoint extension.
The term you have is not.
So your V there is, it does not have a unique self-adjoint extension. It's a symmetric operator which has several self-adjoint extensions.
But you can see
Lorentz
and
Lorentz. Of course you can.
Depends on the coefficient. So you said you have the
right. That's the question of why I've been keeping my things less than 3/4. That's what becomes an integral test on my wave function.
Are there any more questions?
Yes. I just want to see where we arrived at. So if I understand, I mean, there was a lot of things leading us, motivating this this final Lagrangian that you wrote down. But in the end, you just said, let's add this particular counter term.
That's one way to look at it.
If we
but you wouldn't have
tried to take the continuum limit using this version of the Lagrangian,
right.
Then the theory is renormalizable.
Right.
In fact, it only has finites.
Right.
At least order by order and perturbation.
Even the canonical commutation relations that disappear in the continuum limit. It becomes the affine commutation relations, a different ballgame altogether. Sorry about that. But you're right. I could have started giving you, this is my lattice action, and you would have said, hey, where the hell did that come from? Why that? I could have given you this crazy looking counter term, and you would have said, that's not correct, or that's crazy.
This is the next one.
How would you know that, right? Who would think to start with that? No. You got to go back a few more to get a more plausible ansatz.
Oh, he's gone.
So there's another, basically there is another renormal, but I guess the question will be, if you go and apply this to something like the standard model, then will it have implications for the Higgs mass or something like that?
Okay.
Because then that's involved,
so
that's closely related to this kind of phenomenon that you're talking about.
I don't want to argue about the gauge bosons because there's no gauge invariant scalar that I can make without derivatives or anything. I don't want that. So I agree it could have implications for the Higgs boson. Could have implications for gravity, I do believe. And gravity is already ready to have its measure not looking like dx, but it's much more like a dx over an x in order to, I'm talking metric now, tg over g or determinant g, in order to have some kind of scale invariant. So it's almost begging you to reinterpret it in the kind of discrete lattice form that would make these things finite.
Also, is it true that you didn't add another free parameter to the
I didn't.
To the ground?
There was no free parameter. Absolutely not.
Absolutely.
I love everyone.